Hi, everyone. It's Jivana. I just want to come on for a moment and thank our sponsor, OfferingTree. They're an all-in-one, easy-to-use, community-backed business that saves you time, energy, and money as a yoga teacher. OfferingTree allows you to create a website in less than 30 minutes. Plus, you get a discount through Accessible Yoga. Just go to offeringtree.com/accessible yoga to get your discount today. Okay, here's our episode.
Welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. This podcast explores the teachings of yoga for self and collective transformation. We dive into how spirituality and philosophy can ignite social change. I share conversations with folks who are on the front lines of justice and liberatory movements, thought leaders, change makers, and healers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. And today we have with us Michelle Cassandra Johnson, one of my favorite yoga teachers and a person who has really influenced and inspired me to do the work that I'm doing today. So I'm really excited to have this particular conversation with Michelle. For those of you who don't know Michelle's work, she is an anti-racism trainer, a social justice activist, a yoga teacher, an author of several books, one of which has been pivotal in my own path. And the last one which she's written is the one which I have had the distinct honor to write a foreword. Our True Nature is the book, and it's out for a pre-ordering. So today Michelle and I are going to talk about many things, including this book and her process of writing and her work in the world. So very, very warm welcome to you, Michelle. I'm so excited to have you here join me today.
Thank you so much, Anjali. My throat has been a little scratchy all day. Mm-hmm. Thank you for inviting me to be here, and thanks for being in community with me and in the conversation and in the practice and in the work, and especially for writing the foreword for this next book, which comes out on June 4th.
It's a very interesting take on the kleshas. I love the way you have written about the kleshas. Could you share your journey into the writing? What made you write about this particular topic? What was your process like?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I've written several books. Illuminating Our True Nature is my fifth book. And I named that because writing Illuminating Our True Nature was different than any other book I've written thus far. And I think the seed of the idea to write it was present before my editor, Beth Frankel from Shambhala Publications, sat down and said, I think you should write this book. I think it was already there, mainly because I was teaching in Boston about skill in action. And I taught a little section about the kleshas in this immersion, this weekend immersion. And I taught about them before, but Beth happened to be in this session with me, where she watched me, heard me, experienced listening to my perspective on the kleshas and just my process and learning about them, and looking at the kleshas as a way to better understand our suffering as it relates to what's in the way of justice was definitely the lens that I was looking through and working through in that weekend immersion. And then Beth, we went out to dinner and she said, I think you need to write a book about the kleshas. And at first I was like, okay, let me think about this. The other thing I should name about my writing process is this was the first book that someone suggested. Mm. Maybe you want to write this. The other books, I mean, they were suggested, but it was more from like spirit or my grandmother, Dorothy, or the work I'd been doing for a long time. And they originated from a different place. And so I think when she said it to me, I was like, okay, yeah, maybe. And I let it sit for a while. And then I started to write about the kleshas based on what I'd been teaching about them. And obviously went through, you know, a book proposal and worked with Beth and Shambhala on that. And then I had to start writing more intensively about the kleshas. And it took me, the book has 15 chapters. I think I was 6 chapters in before I felt like, okay, it makes sense that you're writing this in this way at this time, which was also a new experience. I had a lot of clarity with Finding Refuge, which is about personal and collective grief, right? I had a lot of clarity at the time when the first edition of Skill in Action came out in 2017 that I had something to say about justice in yoga. And I was very clear. And with Illuminating Our True Nature, I went through a process of wondering whether or not I should write it based on my social location and identities. I'm a Black, cisgender, middle-class, US citizen, many other identities, who learned a lineage of yoga that was not Kemetic yoga, but yoga from India. And so I had a whole process of wondering, am I the appropriate person to write this? And if I, even though I was 6 chapters in, all of those chapters felt like a struggle, the first 6. And so I just sat in like deep discernment around it, about it, and thought, yeah, I have something connected to what I wrote in Skill in Action and connected to who I am in the world and connected to how I teach to say about suffering and my own work with the kleshas and my samskaras and my tendencies and patterns and the karma that is unfolding on the planet. I do actually have something to say about that. I also sat in discernment about how to honor the practice given how I came to it. Again, that was rooted in, are you the person to write this? And what manifested is a book, I think, that is accessible, applicable, has many stories from my life and path of yoga, and invites contemplation about why we are suffering individually and collectively, and what are some practices we can engage to investigate, I would say, this suffering and also heal at the same time. So it was a journey. This book was a journey all of them have been a journey, but this was a, do you need to write this? Are you the right person to write this? How do you move through this process with integrity? And then after chapter 6 and talking to Thajal, we had a phone conversation, not about the book, but we had a phone conversation about something else. I think we were just connecting, and Thajal said, you will have to like move through every klesha as you're writing about it. Thajal's words were very true. I mean, I was in the midst of it anyway, but it landed in quite a different way as I journeyed through writing these 15 chapters and channeling practices and like which practice here to respond to avidya, the first klesha about separation or a lack of clear sight or the belief that we are separate. So I feel really proud of it now, and I'm excited for it to be worked with. And the energy of it feels like Skill in Action to me, in the sense of how people might engage with it and use it and the consciousness that could be raised through it. But you know what you said about it, like it's sort of an interesting take on the kleshas. Beth Frankel, my editor at Shambhala, said the same thing. She was like, it's really compelling the way you've written about them, because I've tried to offer story and also invite people into seeing themselves in the stories and how the kleshas apply to them, and what's happening, as I said, on our planet. So I feel good about it. I'm so grateful you said yes to writing the foreword. And I couldn't think of another person to write. Like, I'm so glad you said yes to it, and for your voice and your work and your inspiration. So thank you.
Well, I think it was a full-bodied yes. When you emailed me, and I'm a no person 90% of the time. And, you know, very few people have been like, yes. So when Michelle asked me, I'm like, of course, because like I said, when I first read Skill in Action, I was looking for some things which I did not know was out there. And then when I read it, I was like, this is it. This is exactly what I felt. And you articulated that integration that I was looking for about the work in the world and the yoga practice. How, and it's always been integrated, which we sometimes don't know how to put the words in there. So your words were really pivotal for my path from then on. So it was a true honor. I want to go back to what you were talking about, you know, healing, especially now, given the heartbreak. I mean, I feel like I'm saying this for the past, I don't know how many years, but particularly now, because I don't think we as a human being, whatever, family, are capable of even processing nervous system wise what we are witnessing, like in lifetime, the genocides, multiple genocides that are happening in Palestine, Sudan, Congo, and specifically Palestine because of the amount of information that is coming there, right? I mean, I don't know whether we are capable of even processing that, but we have to. So I want to ask your insight into what healing can look like at a time like this.
This is the question.
Yeah.
Right? I feel this deeply in my bones, what you're naming about the time we're in and how we process it, because I'm trying to figure out how to process it. And it feels like it's too much.
Yeah.
The magnitude of what is unfolding and then the expectation that we are supposed to function.
Yeah,
exactly. In somewhat like, I mean, I do have my meetings, but I'm supposed to do this meeting. I'm supposed to meet these expectations, as if we can continue to operate in the same way when what our nervous systems are responding to is something, at least in this incarnation of self, that I've never experienced before in this way, coupled with the information and how we receive information now and the amount of information about the multiple genocides happening on the heels of a global pandemic, which is still, we're trying to recover from, and also people are still suffering from it. So,
yeah.
And amid political unrest, like,
yeah,
it is the question I hold most of the time around how can we expect our nervous systems to settle? How can we expect to attune to one another? How can we engage in healing when we are experiencing an onslaught of violence and trauma on top of ancestral trauma that we all carry in some way? Mm-hmm. I've been very present to the grief. I mean, I'm present to it. I feel like I have been present to grief for a long time, but the heaviness I feel in my spirit and the, I don't even know if it's my relationship to uncertainty at this time, because I don't know what's going on, yeah. But there's something about, I have a lot of fear about what is going to happen. I'm not predicting the future. I don't know what's happening, but I've been noticing in the last month, a lot of, I wouldn't say anxiety, but maybe that's coming out in some way. Definitely. I'm afraid for us, and I'm afraid for the planet. I don't say that to add to the intensity of what my nervous system or your nervous system or anyone else who's listening is trying to process. It's just where I'm locating myself in this place of deep grief and intense fear, although it's not debilitating. And so what I've been curious about in healing, which is what your question is about, is, the process that I think we need to go through to acknowledge what is happening, to tune into the nervous system, to understand that our cells are changing in response to the traumas that are unfolding in the world right now, and the sorrows that we are experiencing, even though we don't feel as if we are. Some people are like, it's not affecting me. I just think there's no way to be alive without being affected by what's going on, what's in the air, the news we're receiving, the information, the helplessness people may feel because I'm very present to the ways in which I did not consent to participate in genocide.
Yep.
I never said yes to that. And yet I am contributing to and participating in multiple genocides. And that my nervous system is unsure of what to do with. Like, it's like, I don't know what to do with this. And so I feel like acknowledging that, acknowledging what's going on, acknowledging that we don't know, acknowledging we're afraid, acknowledging we're grieving, finding places of joy where we can, mitigating suffering where we can, when we can, that these are all practices that are healing practices. And to me, there's a big part of this that feels like it's about community too. Because even saying to you how I'm feeling and relating to you is healing to me, mm-hmm. or having someone say, what's going on with your nervous system or your heart, or how are you? That is healing. And I have individual healing practices too, but they're not, I'm always in community. I'm never not in community. So always in community in some way. And I think we need our practices, and I think we need each other. And I've felt this way forever and ever, but especially now, because there's a way that I think we're lost. Yeah. And I'm thinking about a practice such as yoga to bring us back to ourselves and one another, like a spiritual practice to bring us back to the truth of who we really are amid so much playing out and patterns and samskaras that are related to, you know, us moving away from our humanity, us disrupting the natural order, us being born into systems and inheriting them instead of consenting, right, to what is happening. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I'm thinking a lot about healing and what it looks like given the current context.
Exactly. No, yeah. I think I totally understand. I totally get the value of somebody affirming that this is an unprecedented experience for us in the human, you know, to be distant from it physically, geographically, and to witness it, to participate in it, like you said, without consent, we are participating. So I think one of the biggest things that we can do is to really just offer that space for each other and affirm each other's distress. You know, I think that in itself is such a big part of the healing process. I don't know whether I would use the word healing, but definitely an affirming, validating process, and that is really important.
Hi, everyone. I just want to pop in here really quick and remind you about our sponsor, Offering Tree. As yoga teachers, we are our own business managers, website designers, and producers. It's a lot. And Offering Tree offers an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to succeed while we're doing all the things. And I'd just like to say that through this partnership with the Love of Yoga podcast, Offering Tree has shown that it's committed to supporting accessibility and equity in the yoga world. Offering Tree is a public benefit corporation, and they're driven by a mission of wellness accessibility, which we share with them at Accessible Yoga. As an Offering Tree user, you'll get to join a supportive educational community, and you'll also get free webinars with top experts in wellness and entrepreneurship. And of course, you get a discount. So go to offeringtree.com/accessibleyoga to learn more and to get your discount. Okay, let's go back to the episode.
Let's shift gears a little bit. And I've always been interested in asking you this question. What are some of your particular rituals when you start writing? If it's okay to share? Because I'm an aspiring writer, so I just wanted to ask you that.
You are a writer.
Like writing a proposal and all of that.
I don't know any of that. You're a writer. That's already happened. It's in motion. It is. Speaking of ritual, I mean, it took me a long time to claim that part of myself as a writer.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then I like looked at three books on my bookshelf that had my name that had been published by, you know, it's kind of like, what else do you need? You are a writer. And now there's more ease. So part of the ritual is affirming and reclaiming the part of myself that has always been a storyteller. And it's manifesting through writing. I mean, storytelling can happen in many, many ways, many creative ways that for me feels like it's coming through in my writing. And there are many rituals, and they've also been specific to different projects, book projects. And the rituals are what's included in them is like the time of day when I'm writing, or connecting to ancestors as I'm preparing to write, or praying or pouring libations, or meditating and asking. This happened a lot with illuminating our true nature. I meditate every day in the morning typically, but I was meditating and sitting and listening for direction and information, especially because I felt a tension in myself about, do I need to write this? Let me listen. Let me ask. Let me listen. That was part of my ritual through meditation for this particular book. But sometimes meditation has been, I'm working on a book about honeybees right now, and my ritual is meditating and listening to the sound of a hive, the hum of a hive for 20 minutes each morning, which is helpful for many reasons, actually, and quite healing. Mm-hmm. If people want to try that, the frequency of it, the vibration, the theta waves, the things that are accessed for us if we listen to that kind of a healthy hum of a hive. So I've been doing that as a ritual, and making offerings to the honeybees. So I have, and with Finding Refuge, which is about grief, I wrote about different people and losses I'd experienced and the losses we are experiencing as a collective, of course. And I had to build altars for like every chapter, for every person I was writing about, or the environment or the planet, right? Anything I was writing about. So I have a lot of different rituals that help me prepare to write, and that support me as I write, like calling on ancestors, opening myself as a channel to write, and recognizing that I'm not, even with the first edition of Skill in Action, I've always been someone who feels like a channel where information is moving through me. So I don't feel I'm responsible in some way, but I don't feel as if Michelle Cassandra Johnson said these words. I want to be like, grandma said these words and they happen to come through me and land in a book that has my name on it, but really her name should be on it. You know, it's like, that's how I feel about the ritual of writing. And that requires me to do certain things like pray, meditate, all the things I named, settle my nervous system, journey shamanically to the spirit of the honeybee or someone else, right? Continue to ask, am I the person to write this now? And wait for answers to come, and how do I write, or rituals around dreaming, even as I prepare to dream and go to sleep, and how that's led into writing the next day. So I have a ton of rituals like that. And then I have rituals that relate, as I said, to time of day and structure. So each book has been written at a different time of day, meaning the honeybee book is in the morning and then I'm distracted. Skill in Action written at nighttime. Finding Refuge was written in often in the middle of the day, actually, after building an altar. I don't remember when I wrote We Heal Together because I don't remember that book. Like, I don't remember it moving through me. So it's just been interesting to watch, but I have a commitment to writing, which feels like a ritual, right? A commitment to setting myself up and thinking about what supports do I need to make it possible to channel and have that turn into a chapter in this particular book, whatever it might be.
Love that. I'm going to start thinking about these things this way too, because I'm very haphazard. I just like, when I get into the mood, I write like something has come in, and then suddenly I don't want to see that thing for another 2-3 days. So it's not very structured, but I think maybe I should get in some structure. So I'll definitely lean into some of those practices. Thank you for sharing those. I was also wanting to ask, One, another question about your writing, which is especially for Black and Brown people who, and I know I'm experiencing that a lot, and I don't want to use the words, you know, the imposter syndrome and all of that, but I think that that definitely plays in, and it's a system that has sort of not only cultivated it in a very intentional way, but it has conditioned us in so many ways, our samskaras, our own avidya in that, right? So what would you tell someone who is, especially from the Black and Brown community, who is wanting to share their voice in any way? Like you said, you don't have to write to share your story, but you can do so many other things. What are some of the things that you can share for people who want to write, want to express, and yet feel they're not ready, or maybe this is not the time?
Yeah, I appreciate this question because I think there is, as you said, so much conditioning around what is possible for us as Black and Brown folks, or really any group who's marginalized, but you specifically asked about Black and Brown folks, which resonates with me. I'm a Black person who has definitely been conditioned to believe that I'm limited in some way, or that I can't access certain parts of myself and offer them like writing and story as a gift in the world and have them be received and have them be appreciated and have them move people and inspire people. I mean, this is, it's making me think of what, you know, positioning myself in a way that leans into what is possible when I believe in myself so much. I don't mean from an egoic place. I mean, when I'm operating out of the constraints that white supremacy has placed on me, what is possible? That's what I'm speaking to. And I recognize imposter syndrome and have experienced it in many different spaces, and in particular with writing, as we've been talking about, and claiming myself as a writer. And I've experienced this with other folks I've worked with, Black and Brown folks who are wanting to write and have to work through all of the messaging that often they received from other people about their ability to write or from the educational system, right? Okay. These messages didn't derive from them. They came from systems which want us to stay silent, stay small, stay in place, and not center our narratives. And that for me, I think it fuels a fire for me about then the importance of sharing our narratives and centering them anyway, right? Because the system as it is structured is really never going to make space for our stories. So we have to make space for our stories. And there are so many models of people who have done this that we can look to, even as they have received messages about their smallness or messages that they are invalid or that no one will want to hear their stories. I mean, there's so many inspirations. So I would invite people to think about who inspires you, who has modeled offering story writing anyway, even though they may have experienced imposter syndrome or may still be experiencing it. And yet they're sharing their story anyway. Like that to me is, that tension is really interesting and also inspiring for me. So I would invite people to that and to really interrogate, where did these messages come from and why are they in place? And often, as I said, they're to keep us in place so that we don't uplift our truths or even the creative way, creative offering, the creative way we want to write. And I also think you asked about ritual earlier, and it's coming back to me now with imposter syndrome. It's also coming back to me when I think about yoga and some of the teachings. This wise person, when Skill in Action came out in 2017, this wise person said, release it and let it do what it's going to do. And I thought, I can do that. I don't know what it's going to do. I have an intention, but I don't know what it's going to do. And at the time when she said it to me, I was like, okay, this makes sense. Let go of your attachment to what happens with this, because really you wanted to write a story and share your perspective. And you do want it to inspire others and people to learn from it. Of course, we want that. And let it do what it's going to do. It's its own thing. When you create something, it becomes its own thing, right? When it is, I mean, we know, like, whatever we're birthing becomes its own thing. People who are parents know this. Your children become their own people. You can influence them. You can shape them. They are socialized by the world, and yet they will become who they become. I mean, this is true of creative projects, I think, too. And just so many things we're generating. And I share this with in relationship to imposter syndrome, because there was something very liberating about that. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I trusted myself enough to write this down and to go through the process of, for that edition, self-publishing when I knew nothing about it. Like, that's not my world. And I believe in myself enough to have created this at the time, the book I could hold in my hand. To me, that means something. And at the time was enough to be like, I'm putting it out there and it will do what it's going to do. And so I would offer that, like, what is that for people who may be experiencing imposter syndrome? If you trust yourself enough to begin to create it, right? And you trust your voice enough to talk about it, there's something there. There's an offering there. Is what I would share about it, and then trust it to become what it needs to become.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I love that. I think a lot of people who listen hopefully get inspired to share their voice. Recently, you were a part of Affinity Space, which I held, talking about caste and religion. And it just felt so nourishing to be in that space. And I love the book that you wrote about affinity spaces as well. So I want to kind of uplift that, because I think having people of especially marginalized communities together is so affirming and so nourishing, given the world that we're living in and always. So could you share a little bit about that book also? Because I think that is a really, really powerful book.
Yeah, I appreciate you asking about it. It's actually sitting on my desk right here.
A space for us. Yes,
a space for us. I had it here because I co-led a course about it. But it's a space for us, a guide for leading Black, Indigenous, and people of color affinity groups. And it was published by Beacon and came out in August of 2023. And I love it because, to your point, in the space we were in most recently, it is a book just for people of the global majority, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And it is a book about really reclaiming space for ourselves in the way we were just talking about, connected to imposter syndrome, and coming back to ourselves. And also it is about being in community, specifically affinity space, and the healing that can happen when we have space separate from the white gaze or a little bit, I'm saying a little bit removed from white supremacy, because whiteness can still show up in a BIPOC affinity space. But there's a certain amount of distance from that. And we can explore how whiteness is affecting our space and how we've been shaped by it, and then contemplate, how do we want to be in relationship and heal with one another, given that we have a shared experience of systemic racism, even though our individual experiences may have been different, but there's the shared experience of it based on the racial hierarchy. So this book is, I think, for anyone who is interested in learning more about identity and how they relate to themselves, as it's connected to race specifically, although there are other applications of affinity groups for sure, based on points of privilege or points of oppression and how we experience marginalization. And it is also a book for anyone wanting to create an affinity space or participate in an affinity space. And it has a lot of information about frameworks that we might want to understand that will help us more deeply understand ourselves, and also if we're going to facilitate an affinity space. But it also has how do we come into group process, and what rituals do we want to call in, and what is the role of ritual within these spaces, mm-hmm. and what might emerge in a space within the context of an institution versus in community? Those are mm-hmm. different contexts when we think about our work and justice, and also affinity spaces specifically. An institution might create some challenges that in community would be different, right? The way mm-hmm. we would experience challenges. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of, as all of my books do, journaling prompts for deeper self-reflection. It has an entire chapter about internalizations and our shaping and socialization, about healing, about collective liberation. So I'm really grateful for it. And it actually was, if I think about it, I'm not comparing it really, but there was a contrast between writing a space for us and illuminating our true nature. That makes sense based on what I've shared thus far about how I had to ask myself, do I need to write this? Although I think I ask myself that with each book, but in a different way. The space for us just came out. I've been an anti-racism educator for over 2 decades. It was waiting to come out of me. And I realized that as I started to write it. And there are a ton of contributors to a space for us too, that I've been in relationship with and work with from different racial identities and ethnicities, to share some about their experience of affinity groups. So people can, if they're interested in any of what I just shared about it, check it out.
Great. Thank you. I really personally like that book a lot because I thought it was really needed. And I love the way you have laid out the frameworks. So I wanted to kind of share about that. And all the information for all these books are on your website. So for folks to go and take a look at it. Closing question. I know we can talk forever, but a closing question would be probably to talk about what are some of your thoughts about our own practices on an everyday basis? I know I'm inspired from what you're sharing about what you do every day to write your book and, you know, what inspires you. I think that's so lovely to hear, actually. What are some of the things that you do every day to take care of yourself, especially when there is so much grief going on? I ask this for everyone, but particularly you also. What are some of your practices, rituals, things like that?
Yeah, I love this question. For many reasons. One reason why is what I've learned throughout time is that my practice has deepened and also has had to shift in some ways based on the world and how I'm responding to it and relating to it, reacting. Mm-hmm. And I just name this, and I've named it before in different ways, but I name it because sometimes I think we need a practice, and sometimes I just know in myself, the practice has to be different for mm-hmm. what I'm moving through. Yeah. So I would invite people to have a practice and also have some flexibility mm-hmm. about what's speaking to you or what you feel like you need based on what you're feeling, how you're feeling. And so some ways I take care of myself, and I know there's a way to think about like me and how I take care of myself, but I think about care as many people do and been talking about, especially in the circles we're in, or activist spaces or spaces for transformation, that care, our individual care, is connected to collective care, which is actually the book we began talking about. The subtitle is Yogic Practices for Personal and Collective Healing, right? That there's this relationship. So whenever I engage in what one might call self-care, it's not, mm-hmm. It's not really that. It is how do I tend myself in connection with others, because so much of what I do is rooted in connection and service, right? It's to something bigger than me, for something bigger than me. And so as I mentioned, I was sharing some rituals about writing, but I'm going to have water.
Yeah.
Speaking of care, my voice is doing all sorts of things today. I even had a spoonful of honey before this, but you know, maybe it's working its way through me and helping with my voice. That's probably what's happening. But I meditate every morning. I pray. I write gratitude statements, 10 each day. I light a candle. And sometimes I pull a card from a divination deck, or do some other kind of divination. And that's kind of like the everyday maintenance.
Yeah.
Those are the practices. But I also care for myself by, right before we came onto this call and for this conversation, I have 3 honeybee hives. And so I went out to see them. And I watched them for a little while, and they needed some water. And so I gave them some water, and I tuned into their hum and just watched them, observe them, going in and out of the hive. So that's something that I can do in my yard, or sit next to the oak tree, which is near the beehives, or look at the chickens and talk to them or give them a treat. Mm-hmm. And then there's the larger ecosystem and natural world, which I find a lot of solace in. And so as much as I can, I'm trying to relate to the world around me, mm-hmm. the more than human world around me, and connect with it so it can remind me of my true nature, right? Mm-hmm. So I can come back to myself. That is a huge resource. And I don't mean that in an extractive way, but it's like a resource that fills me up, is that, you know, I was noticing the sun earlier as it was shining through a tree, and the geese, there's a lake in my neighborhood, the geese that were on the lake. And as the morning was waking up, this was earlier when I was walking Jasper, my dog, I was just trying to be with the aliveness around me and move slow enough to notice who was around me, the sounds, the sensations, the breeze. It was a little breezy this morning. So nature is a way I care for myself. And then there are many other ways, but the one I'll mention is being in community, because I mentioned it before. The practice that has been making me feel better. And I was like kind of surprised by it. And I don't even know why I was surprised by it, but is that with this deep grief that I think I'm moving through, every time I'm in community with others, I feel better. Yeah. Now, I read a whole book about being in community, but for some reason, this is landing differently in my body, where I'm like, oh, I don't feel the heaviness as much. Not that that's the goal or objective, but I notice feeling a little lighter or more connected, or just gratitude for being in community. And so that is a huge care practice, especially because I'm in community with people who, like you, right, where we can talk about heartache or grief or joy or whatever it might be. Like when you ask me how I am, you really want to know. And so when I'm around people like that, that gives me the space to say, I'm great. And also, this is going on, or I'm feeling discombobulated or disconnected, or, you know, to like uplift all of what is moving through in my human experience. And those spaces are really sacred and special. And I'm lucky. And then I get to be in many of them and cultivate and co-create those spaces. So that's a big care practice, community and being seen and seeing others and witnessing.
Beautiful. I cannot think of a better way to close this, because I'm so grateful to be in community with you and continue to learn from you, and just uplift your work. And everyone, please go and take a look at the offerings of Michelle Cassandra Johnson. Thank you so much for joining me and the listeners for listening to this particular conversation.
Thank you, Anjali, for being and for all that you create and offer, and for your many gifts. And thanks for being in community and conversation with me in this way.
Thank you for listening to the Love of Yoga podcast, an offering from Accessible Yoga Association. Please support our work by becoming an ambassador or by visiting our online studio at accessibleyoga.org.